and welcome to another installment of Virtually Speaking Science. I'm your host for tonight, Alan Boyle, science editor at NBCNews.com, and I have, for some years now, I've done a blog called Cosmic Log. You can get to that from CosmicLog.com, and I write about all sorts of things, what's going on with paleoarchaeology or the environment, but one of my favorite subjects has to do with space, and one of my favorite space subjects has to do actually with UFOs, unidentified flying objects. It's fun to delve into it, and what we're going to talk about tonight is why it's fun and how this debate, how this dialogue works between the believers and the people who take a more critical view of things. We have a couple of people who take that critical view with us tonight. Seth Shostak is a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute and the director of the Center for SETI Research based in Mountain View. And he's written a book called Confessions of an Alien Hunter about the real-life search for signals from extraterrestrial civilizations. My other guest tonight is Don Lincoln. He was on last month talking about the Large Hadron Collider, but he also has written a book called Alien Universe about the draw that the alien meme has for society and has had for society through the generations. And Don also talks about the real-life search for aliens and for signs of life on other planets, other worlds. So I thought it'd be fun to just kind of get these folks together and talk about UFOs, about aliens, SETI, extraterrestrial life. So I don't think we're going to have much trouble filling up the hour. I do want to pass along a couple of thanks before we launch into this. Thanks, first of all, to the Exploratorium for hosting us in their Second Life Auditorium. If you haven't experienced the show in Second Life, you really should give it a try, especially tonight, because Seth and Don have avatars that are completely alien in appearance. You'd love it. And we have a good conversation that generally goes on in the Second Life Auditorium. So give it a try sometime. You can also hear us on Blog Talk Radio, and our shows are archived on iTunes and on Blog Talk Radio. I'm just one of the hosts for Virtually Speaking Science. I have a few colleagues who have conversations that are just as scintillating, and I hope you'll listen to them. Jennifer Willett, Tom Levinson, Kelly Hills, they come on and turn Virtually Speaking Science into a weekly event. So please do put that on your listening schedule. So with that, let's turn to the subject at hand, UFOs. And Seth, I wonder if you could lead off with a little bit of a talk about how the UFO meme, the UFO phenomenon, does or doesn't figure into what you do.
Well, Alan, you would think that it probably doesn't, because, of course, my job is to try and find some evidence that the aliens are out there, and not that they're here, right? If I thought that they were here, that would make my job a lot easier, because you wouldn't have to build all these, you know, giant antennas and all that sort of thing. But, in fact, it does impact my work, if I can use impact as a verb there. Because I get phone calls and emails essentially every day from people who have some evidence in hand that the aliens are here. So I do deal with the issue, and people ask about it all the time. It's enormously popular.
And Don, for you, you're dealing more with particle physics than astrobiology, I realize that, but how do you come to this issue? How is it that a particle physicist who works at the Large Hadron Collider got himself mixed up in UFOs and the alien universe?
Well, aside from being very interested in aliens as a child, I grew up in New Hampshire, not very far from the place where Betty and Barney Hill were supposed to have been abducted in 1961, and so it sort of came in my blood. But I had a conversation with some people, and it just struck me how all of us knew what an alien looked like when none of us had seen an alien, nor even a UFO. And that caused me to want to explore the history of aliens in popular culture, and but I couldn't, in good conscience, just do that. I also had to delve into the science of it to try and understand where the fiction became fiction as opposed to being plausible fact.
Yeah, Seth, you've done some talking and some speculating on what these aliens look like, and it is interesting how the typical view of an alien that most people have is this little green man, maybe with those beady black eyes. Where did that come from, and do you think that there's any validity to that image that we have?
Well, of course, if I could answer that second question, Alan, I'd be on my way to Stockholm to pick up a prize.
Or on your way to Vega.
Yeah, or Vega, yeah, sure.
That's right. Maybe they've got a better prize. I have to say, nobody knows. Hollywood writers and directors, producers, they will call you up and ask you what you think the aliens look like. But in the end, they very often go with that iconic alien, the little gray guy without the hair, with a small nose, small mouth, and big eyes. Only because it saves them having to work a backstory into their script. The audience immediately knows that it's an alien. But I don't know where that alien first appeared. That I tried to find out once, but I can't say that I know. I don't think that they're going to look like that. That looks too much like us. I don't know if they're going to look like me, the way I look these days. I think I had a bad bagel, and I developed all these spindly appendages.
In Second Life, I should point out. You don't have spindly appendages that I know of in First Life.
Well, you can't see me, Alan, I'm just telling you. But yeah, but the real aliens, look, the real aliens you're likely to hear, you know, that you might pick up with your radio telescopes, of course, would have to be more advanced technically than we are. So maybe they've moved on to non-biological intelligence. So maybe what would really be sitting in this chair here is some sort of box with flashing lights.
Where does that little green man come from, Don? Did you ever find out anything more about that for your book?
Yeah, sure. The little green man was sort of early 1900s, but it morphed into the gray archetype with Betty and Barney Hill. If you read what they claimed they saw after they were hypnotized, they were small gray individuals. So one thing that they claimed they saw that didn't happen was that they had very large noses like Jimmy Durante. But then during a subsequent hypnosis, one of them drew a picture of what looks very much like the iconic alien. And people are wondering exactly whether that came from their imagination, or there was a television show called Outer Limits that ran a week or two prior to the hypnosis session that looked suspiciously like the iconic alien. And so the combination of the Betty and Barney Hill's notoriety in the UFO community is what really made that happen. And then once it started, people projected it into Roswell. And then from then on, it just was in the culture.
I was going to say that I was surprised that it was Betty and Barney Hill rather than Roswell. And you mentioned that it was projected into the Roswell story. I think in your book you talk about how Roswell had made that little splash at the beginning when they had the newspaper articles about whether the Army Air Force had or had not found this alien craft. But then I think you said that it faded into the background for quite some years. What was it that really brought Roswell to the fore?
Well, a slow day for the National Enquirer, actually. So the original Roswell incident was in September of 1947, which was only a few weeks after the first UFO reports. And it had its splash for a day or two, and then it disappeared. It was just one of many things that came and went. But in 1978, the National Enquirer printed just completely reprinted the story from the Roswell Daily Record back in the 40s. And that caught the attention of UFO researcher Stanton Friedman, who then went back and contacted the Army intelligence officer. And from there, because Stanton Friedman had standing in the UFO community, he brought that story back to life.
Well, I wonder, Seth, whether there have been some. Does Roswell come up with your in your discussions with UFO fans, or what do they refer to? What do they see as the best cases for UFO based on your interactions with folks at these forums?
Yeah, well, I do ask that question, Alan. I say, look, you know, there's a lot of skepticism, at least in the science community, about the hypothesis that Earth is being visited. One-third of the public thinks that's true, but, you know, very few scientists, I should say, you know, certainly the minority of scientists think that there's some truth in that. And I say that your case would be a lot better if instead of telling me that there have been 10,000 reports of something in the sky this year, that's all weak evidence, and 10,000 examples of it doesn't make it particularly stronger. Just show me a really good case. What do you think is the best example, the best evidence for alien visitation? And indeed, maybe one in four, one in five of them will say Roswell. Some will say Randlesham Forest in Britain. Others will, you know, cite other incidents like that in Stevensville, Texas, or the Arizona, the Phoenix Lights, whatever.
Phoenix Lights,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, Phoenix Lights, yeah. Phoenix Lights sounds like something you would, you know, drink at a bar. But the... But,
or
you know,
I think the Phoenix Lights are in spring training right now. You know, they're getting ready for the baseball season.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in any case, but Roswell is fairly popular, but I think that that's a triumph of advertising over product, because it's pretty easy to explain what happened in Roswell, and it's hard to maintain that it was really aliens, and yet, you know, some people have a vested interest. Stan Friedman has already been mentioned. He's made a career out of Roswell, and consequently, he's not about to give up his job.
And if I might say something, I went to Roswell as part of writing the book, and they have this little cute museum there that talks about the incident. But if you go around, most of the information they have are various papers that are put against the walls. And what you find is there are essentially no documentation from the 1940s. What you see are lots and lots of affidavits from the 1979-1980 period, where people are saying, I remember what it was, and this is my story. Nothing was contemporaneous. It was all, you know, memories from 30 years after.
If I could just add a little bit there to what Don said, that's quite correct. And the point is that, you know, witness testimony, even right after an event, is pretty unreliable. There have been movies made, after all, Rashomon and so forth, about, you know, 10 people who witness an event and then they all tell their version of it, and no two versions really agree very well. And 30 years after the event, even fewer of them will agree. So, indeed, this is, you know, not a very good case. I have also been to that museum in Roswell. In fact, I interviewed the woman who runs it. The museum had been founded by her father. And I asked her point blank. I said, do you really think that aliens came who knows how many dozens of light years to visit the land of enchantment and have some Tex-Mex cuisine, and then at the last moment made a navigation error and crashed into the dirt? You think that really happened, you know, 40 miles away here in Corona? And she was very, very cagey about her answer. Her answer, if you read between the lines, the answer I got was, well, I don't really know that that's true. But on the other hand, that was, again, that is her career. That is her livelihood, so she's not going to tell you it didn't happen.
So I'm going to tell a story about my Roswell experience that I've been to that museum too. It was in 1997 for the 50th anniversary of the Roswell incident. And so, of course, there were a whole bunch of people, Stanton Friedman and everybody who was anybody in the UFO community was at this shindig in Roswell. And I remember interviewing Colonel Corso about his UFO testimony, how he had thought he saw aliens sitting in, you know, like a refrigerated box or something in at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or wherever. So it was quite the event. But it was July 4th, the weekend of July 4th, 1997, and it was the same time that the Mars Pathfinder landing was due to take place. And so I and several other people from MSNBC had been down there and were actually broadcasting on the MSNBC cable channel for the Roswell big anniversary. And in the middle of it, we just happened to be tuning in to the Mars Pathfinder landing and monitoring that. There was kind of a lull in the action at Roswell, and so we turned to cover the landing live. And boy, that was just thrilling, fantastic. And it got me to thinking, wow, this real science event is so much more gripping than all these people running around in costumes. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It was a fun festival, really, really great. But just in terms of the real science of going to another planet, this was so much better in my eyes. And yet, not much mention was made at the event of the Mars Pathfinder landing, or what a glorious event it was. And it just struck me that there might be a little bit of a disconnect between the wonder of planetary science and the wonder about, you know, these strange phenomena. I don't know. Have you folks found that there's much of an intersection between those two worlds? Can you be excited about the science that's going on with all these missions to Mars and to Pluto and Saturn, and also be curious about what's going on with these UFOs, or is it either one or the other?
I actually think people can be curious about both. I mean, I'm curious about both. I don't necessarily believe in UFOs. I think they're highly improbable, but it would be really cool if they were. I think if you're inherently interested in the concept of life in space, you can have a curiosity about both of them. The problem is that science, it's sort of, you know, like the Mars probes and stuff. You have robots drilling into rocks and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have quite the same cachet as, you know, an alien chasing you with a ray gun. And so I think there's a kind of, you know, fascination that the fiction gives that the fact doesn't. The fact requires a little bit more discipline, a little more imagination to see that we're the aliens exploring other worlds as opposed to people coming to see us.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's quite possible to be interested in both. I know people who are, you know, convinced that the evidence is good, that the aliens are here, and they're still relatively excited about science. The difference is this, I suppose. Science, at least, you know, part of it is exploration, and so a lot of what we've been talking about is exploration. Going to Mars,
mm-hmm.
you know, sending motorized skateboards to Mars and looking around and see what's there, and, you know, can we dig up any living microbes or dead microbes and stuff like that. That's exploration. But a lot of other science, the kind that Don does, for example, makes predictions, and the UFO phenomenon doesn't make predictions. Now, neither does SETI, except that, you know, we hope we'll find a signal, but it's not really a prediction. It's just an exploration. I do think that there is something interesting, though, about the UFO phenomenon that does strike me, and that is, if they really are here, you know, they are extraordinarily indifferent to us, right? I mean, you know, people say, is there any harm in people thinking that they're visiting us? And I really can't think of terribly much harm, because the aliens never kill anybody. They don't solve any of our problems. They don't interfere with our domestic air transport system. They, you know, they don't seem to do anything except show up on the Fox Channel occasionally.
You forget about
actually,
occasionally impregnating people.
Or probes. But
yeah.
Actually, that kind of fits, Seth, with your conception of how aliens, advanced aliens, would relate to humans. Like, we don't give all that much thought to what the grasshoppers are doing, or we don't try to let the crickets know where the best food is, or try to teach them to use fire. So I suppose that's consistent with this idea that the aliens would be relatively indifferent to the state of humans if there wasn't much commonality, if there wasn't like a common super alien that we were fighting. Why would the aliens bother?
Well, I agree that they may not be the least bit interested in our political problems, our environmental problems, or the problems that we have with reality television. I agree with all that. But on the other hand, if I walked into, a termite mound or something, even though I have no interest in the termites' personal problems, I think that they would note that I'd walk into their mound. I would do something to their environment that would be unmistakable, I would think. I mean, you know, this is a long trip for them to come to Earth, and if all they're going to do is just, you know, kind of buzz the countryside and not do anything more than that, maybe it's possible, but honestly, it seems unlikely to me. And beyond that, why is it that when I, you know, go down to O'Hare Airport to pick up, you know, to catch a flight, I never have to sit on the tarmac an extra amount of time? Well, I always have to do that, but I never have to do it. but I never have to do it because they're unauthorized craft in the area.
Good point. And we're getting some good questions in the chat room, so I thought I would pass a couple of them along. One is from CC Carolina. Many people think that aliens have visited Earth because there have been many reports from military pilots and commercial pilots that have not been explained. How can the naysayers say that aliens have not visited Earth? And I think both of you would probably have something to say on that. Let's start with Don.
Well, the problem is anecdotal results and anecdotal reports are great for generating hypotheses. But if you're going to do something scientifically, you need to have some evidence. And let me turn the point around, because my father-in-law swears that, being of Irish heritage, that he was occasionally visited with leprechauns. And I have never meant to lie, but I also don't actually believe that he saw leprechauns. Now, if he'd come up and given me a pot of gold and a little hat, he would be more persuasive. And I think that's what the difference is. If you want to convince the community, you're going to need more than reports. And while people point to authoritative figures like pilots, especially military pilots or police officers and so forth, they're human too and can misinterpret data just as well as any other person.
Yeah, and I've talked to several of the astronauts who claim to have seen what they think are alien craft, and these are reputable people. They're not lying. You know, it's just that they're interpreting what they saw as being alien craft, and I think that's the danger. It isn't that they didn't see these things. The people that call me up every day and want to report something or send me videos or send me photos, I mean, they've honestly seen something, and they're by and large, they're honest. They're not trying to pull a hoax. The difficulty is if you say, but how do you know that what you saw was actually an alien craft? Because there might be 100 other explanations which don't involve anything quite as esoteric as alien visitation. So at that point you say, okay, I hear what you're saying, but unless you can give me, you know, a real smoking gun piece of evidence, then I'm going to say, you know, I'm just not convinced, because you're making an extraordinary claim.
And mm-hmm. I might add that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof.
I've heard that before. Also, the idea that just because you can't explain a phenomenon doesn't mean it's unexplainable. In fact, it's always harder to try to explain something than to bring up something that looks weird. I remember there was this video of these objects that were just buzzing quickly, seemed like they were buzzing faster than any aircraft could possibly travel through the sky, and it turned out that the best explanation was that there were bugs in front of the camera that were flying around, and because it's a two-dimensional video, you can't really tell that they are actually 2 feet away from you rather than 5 miles. So it's easy to, I won't say it's easy, but it's easier to come up with something that seems inexplicable than to go through all the possible explanations and really track it down. But usually if you put enough effort into it, you can track that down.
That's true. But another argument that's often made is that after all, there have been lots of efforts to try and explain the better UFO reports, particularly back at the end of the 1940s, well into the 1950s, and even to the beginning of the 1960s, because I think that the government was interested to know whether there was anything that they had to worry about, were these Soviet craft or something like that. So they did try and nail down what these things were. And typically, they would get a bunch of experts together, and the experts would say, give us the best 100 cases, and they would be able to explain maybe 90 of them, typically that, 90 of them as aircraft or balloons or, you know, birds. I mean, there was a whole laundry list of things they might be. And there were always, you know, on the order of 10%, 15%, 5% that they couldn't explain. Well, you can't say that those are alien craft. That's an argument from ignorance. That's saying, I don't know what it was, so it must have been alien craft. It's, you know, it's just like the police don't solve all the murders, that you can be pretty certain that all the murders were committed by humans, not aliens.
Mm-hmm. So here's another question. Seth, you've said that you would like to send the entire contents of Google's servers to the aliens. Have you ever figured out how long it would take to transmit all the information on Google's servers?
I have, and in fact, the answer to that depends on how you do it. If you use a microwave radio transmitter, you know, a big transmitter like we have on some of the radars, for example, or even the Arecibo Radio Telescope has a big transmitter, million watts, so it's heavy duty. And you know, if you just put the information there and send it out, it would take you maybe a couple of months to send the Google servers, or maybe, you know, most of it. If you, however, used a modulated laser, in other words, you used a big bright light that you aimed at the sky, well, light is much higher frequency than radio, so you can have a much wider bandwidth for the information. And so you could send the Google servers in a couple of days. So, yeah, if you're willing to spend a couple of days beaming stuff to any given star system and you do it with a beam of light, then you could send them the Internet. Yes, you could.
Don, have you delved into what the potential messages are that could be sent to the aliens, or what form people would like to see those messages? I think Seth has referred to the Arecibo message, which was kind of an elaborately coded radio message that we hope that the aliens would be able to figure out. What sorts of messages have been proposed to send to the aliens, or what sorts of messages do we think we might get other than, say, the contents of an alien Google server in a dialect that might be tough for us to figure out?
You know, I think the first way that aliens are going to hear from humanity might be reruns of Gilligan's Island. I mean, after all, we've been broadcasting.
We're in trouble.
Well, if there's this lovely movie of Galaxy Quest where aliens misunderstood our fiction, and it was a funny movie. But I think if we were ever, found evidence of a signal, a modulated signal from another star, what we would do is we would send a signal to them and then just start talking. I mean, after all, it's going to be 5, 10, 15, 20, many years for it to even get there. And so to have a back-and-forth dialogue where you ask questions and answer them is just not really very practical. I think it's a matter of people will talk with a, many-year delay between the question you ask and the answer you get.
Seth, I know you've done a lot of work on this sort of question, how you structure communication. What's the current thinking on that?
Well, Don makes the essential point. It's kind of one-way communication, because if the nearest aliens are, Don was being optimistic, let's say the nearest aliens are 100 light years away, that just means when you say hello and they come back and they say, yeah, we're here, that took 200 years, by which point your funding is run out. So that's part of the reason that I say send a Google server, send it all at once so that we don't have to waste time with all those introductories. It's been the case that in the past we've tried sending stuff to the skies. We've tried bolting bolted greeting cards on the sides of the Voyager and the Pioneer spacecraft, very simple graphics or records with sounds and music and, a little bit of Chuck Berry and a little bit of, I think there was some Beethoven on there too, but whatever. You could do those little greeting cards, but I honestly think it's much better to send a lot of stuff, because not only does it save time, but also it might be that they can figure more of it out because it's so redundant. I might point out that at least in the radio regime, all we've done is send these short greeting cards, too. I mean, in 1977, there was one sent from Arecibo, and it was like, I think, 1,679 bits. That's hardly anything. NASA sent the Beatles song, you know, across the universe to the North Star back in, what, 2008. And, you know, a Doritos chip ad has been sent in space, too.
Even whale songs have been transmitted up there, although there's a question about really how much the aliens would be able to latch onto, even if it were Gilligan's Island. They might not be able to figure out this Ginger versus Marianne thing very easily. What sort of interaction have you had, Seth, with folks on the UFO? It sounds as if it adds a little bit of spice to your life to be in a dialogue with these folks. And is it a teachable moment for you? Do you feel as if you're able to impart something to folks who think the aliens are here that is really useful and maybe opens a new world to people?
Well, adding some spice to my life sounds like my life is a Mexican meal, Alan. It probably could use that spice. It does. I mean, I find it interesting, and I encourage people because, as I say, the people who call me up are all very sincere. And I enjoy talking to them. In general, I enjoy talking to them. And if they have photos or videos, I encourage them to send them to me. I say right out, right up front, this is not my job to look at this stuff, so I'm not expert. You know, I haven't been trained in this stuff, and I certainly don't have any time to go visit, you know, some location where you've seen something. But if you want to send me the photos and the videos, I'll take a look at them, because I've done both for a long, long time. I mean, photography happens to be a hobby. So very frequently I can indeed say, you know what this is? This is internal reflection in your zoom lens, right? And I have to say that while I am fairly certain that that is true whenever I say it, I don't always get thanks for that. People are not always grateful for you telling them that what they thought was a major discovery is, in fact, just internal reflection in their zoom lens.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. How about you, Don?
Well, I probably get fewer contacts on that particular subject than Seth does. I have gotten a couple of people who have been very concerned about the aliens that are visiting us in the impending invasion. And what they do is they send me hand-drawn pictures of UFOs hovering over some installation, and they draw very carefully the laser cannons that are necessary to defend from the invasion, and they ask me if I would spend some time inventing the laser cannons.
Oh, good. Well, that's helpful. Let's see. We've got some observations about great short stories in science fiction where it turns out that the first alien message is the interstellar equivalent of a Nigerian scam. that there's a lot of humor that goes into this, and I think that you've referred to this, Don, that actually a lot of what's going on with the alien meme is a reflection of what's going on with society. Just as, for example, Verdi wrote operas about, ancient Rome or whatever that were really a reflection of what was going on in modern society, science fiction and references to UFOs or life beyond Earth often reflect what's going on in our own society. And I think that, for example, Star Trek was a great example of that with the recent passing of Leonard Nimoy. People noted once again that Star Trek kind of took these themes of the 60s, you know, the concept of race and turned it into a show plot with Frank Gershon as half black, half white guy and his nemesis as being half white, half black, mm-hmm. and how they just couldn't stand each other. But are there things about the UFO meme that reflect what the trends in society are, even going back in earlier generations? Did you find anything out about that for your book, Don?
Well, it's not just UFOs. Even prior to that, with Edgar Rice Burroughs and John Carter of Barsoom, I mean, that was reflections of the very last vestiges of European imperialism. You know, you had the the noble white ex-military guy going and interacting with the savages and the ruined cultures from a long time ago. Science fiction of this kind, specifically the alien fiction, just has to reflect the interests of the society in which it's in. I mean, if you had a story that you were going to tell about star-crossed lovers with a species that had three genders and they were slightly the consistency of lime jello, and you tried to sell that on TV, it just wouldn't resonate with people in the same way that, say, Star Wars does, which is a, you know, classic pirate story. Everybody can relate to the hidden prince and the evil emperor and so forth. And which I think you find in the alien stories is it does reflect the society of the time. I mean, think about the science fiction, the UFO and the alien stories in the 50s, where you had Red Scares and you know, worries about the evil Soviet Empire. So it often reflects what people are worried about.
Which makes me wonder what the future of alien stories is going to be. I suppose some people are going to pick up on this whole thing with ISIS and the Islamic State, and you'll have that sort of clash of cultures transmogrified perhaps into a science fiction alien plot. I suppose that's the next step. I'm just shooting, shooting stuff out for speculation right now. But
I actually wouldn't be surprised, although I admit I have not seen much of the science fiction that revolves around terrorism, which seems to be, at least in the States, the concern for the last decade. But that, we'll have to see if that evolves that way.
So here's another question from CC Carolina. Do you think that the Fermi paradox is explained by the hypothesis that many planets in the universe are bombarded by gamma rays, and so life just doesn't have a chance to exist most of the time? And the Fermi paradox is basically, where are they? If the universe is so big and life is even a little bit common in the universe, there should be just scads of alien civilizations broadcasting, and it would be like the AM dial for someone like Seth Shostak. And so why is that? Could gamma rays explain it, Seth?
Yeah, well, the Fermi paradox goes even farther than just having a lot of critters out there. It says, look, if any of them are interested enough to colonize the galaxy, there's been plenty of time for them to do that. And the fact that we don't see a colony everywhere, it would be like living in Europe and seeing no indication that there are Romans around, right? And you'd say, well, that's a little peculiar. And so that's the paradox. But I don't know that gamma rays will solve the problem. Actually, there are gamma ray bursters that go off. CC Caroline is right about that. And if you're near one, it's bad news because, that you might not survive it, though. The biology on your planet might not survive that. But on the other hand, here's a case, Earth is a case, of a planet that has had life on it for 3.5 billion years at least, uninterrupted. In other words, nothing has wiped it all out. Asteroids, ice ball Earth, all sorts of ice ages. There have been catastrophe after catastrophe, but, life has just managed to survive it all. So that suggests to me that it takes really a very tough environment to keep, societies from developing. So I find that that's, for me, not a very satisfactory explanation, that things like gamma ray bursters are responsible for the fact that we haven't heard anything.
There have been a couple of good books written. I've forgotten the author's names. One is called Rare Earth, and it explains possible reasons for why Earth might be rare in the sense that it has life. And it ranges from things like having a Jupiter in the stellar system that will sweep out the debris that would otherwise pummel planets, and things like having a moon of a similar size to the planet, which stabilizes the rotational axis of the Earth. And, there's a long list of things that have to go right in order to have an environment that is stable. The sun can't fluctuate. It has to have a fairly constant energy output. And, that presumably is rare. Now, there are a lot of stars out there, so I'm quite confident that there are solar systems or stellar systems in which those conditions are held. But, you know, things have to go really right to have the kind of environmental stability that we enjoy here on Earth. So the two books, one is called 50 Answers to the Fermi Paradox, and the other one is Rare Earth. And they're both quite interesting. I enjoyed them both.
I haven't read the 50 Answers, but I do know Rare Earth, and that was written by Peter Ward and Don Brownlee, who are based in Seattle, which is my neck of the woods. Peter Ward is a paleontologist, and Don Brownlee is an astronomer. So that's worth reading if you're really interested in this subject. Seth, what, you were going to say something?
Well, when that book came out in 2000, you know, it was picked up by a reviewer, a science writer, actually, at the New York Times. He wrote about it, and the book became enormously popular. And so suddenly the media wanted to, you know, have discussions about whether this was true. Was Earth really special? And so I have to say that I debated Peter Ward on endless TV shows about this. We became best buddies. We're still good buddies, I have to say. He calls me his evil twin. But if you actually look at it's kind of a laundry list. The book is a laundry list of things that are special about the Earth. You know, Don has already mentioned the fact that we have Jupiter to help clean out or to protect us from incoming asteroids that could otherwise ruin your whole day. Well, to begin with, large planets like Jupiter are not at all rare at all. Actually, you know, they're all over the place. And besides, you know, if you didn't have those, you still wouldn't have that many asteroids. And beyond that, you could argue that actually we suffer because we don't have enough asteroids, right? We wasted 150 million years with the dinosaurs. Now, that was good for Peter Ward because he gets to study them now. But, you know, if the dinos, if there had been more asteroids and the dinos were wiped out 10 million years earlier, we'd have the cure for death now. I mean, I lay this on the fact we don't have enough asteroids. So, and it's true for every item in their laundry list. You can go through it and you say either it's not rare or it's not essential to life. So I honestly think the current estimate by astronomers is that the number of habitable worlds, the kind that could have liquid oceans and, you know, atmospheres in our galaxy, is at least tens of billions, right? So I find it really remarkable to think that this is the only place where anything interesting has happened. This might not even be a very good world.
So what do you say about the Fermi paradox? I suppose the answer would be that, well, we've just started looking and we're just scratching the surface. So who knows what is out there, and who knows if they're still using our particular favorite part of the radio dial to transmit. I think Curious George mentioned that it would be strange if the aliens were so backward as to still be using radio. Do you get that sort of thing? Seth, how do you answer that question about technology basically closing off the potential for communication?
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, the fact that we haven't heard anything doesn't mean terribly much to me. I mean, obviously, we'd be better if we had. I think our funding situation would be enormously better. But I don't find it meaningful in the sense that it doesn't say that nobody's out there. All it says is that we've looked at a very, very small sample of, if you will, the parameter space, you know, the number of stars we looked at, the amount of the radio dial and all that. As far as the Fermi paradox goes, look, you know, Don's already mentioned a book that contains, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds, I don't remember what the number was, of possible explanations for why we don't see evidence of an alien empire. And one of them is that the galaxy could be urbanized a bit. It could be, I mean, if I take you and I blindfold you, Alan, spin you around six times, put you in a plane, and I fly you to 30 miles west of Winnemucca, Nevada, and then take off the blindfold, you know, you might look around and you say, well, I don't see anything here. I mean, no roads, no houses, no people, not much of anything except some scrub. I don't know where I am, but wherever I am, this continent is not inhabited. Well,
good point, yeah.
Maybe that's our situation.
Yeah, space is mind-bogglingly big, as I think basically Douglas Adams said that in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So there's a question, another question on SETI. What are the possible technologies that we could use to try to detect an alien message that are not currently being used by SETI? So I guess that would be directed mostly at you, Seth.
Yeah, well, there are lots of ideas, and many of them are good, I think. One thing you could do, and this has been proposed, is you could say, look, maybe the easiest aliens to find are the most advanced aliens, because maybe they make more noise, whatever noise means. And there's been a proposal, for example, to build a very large but very specialized optical telescope. In other words, you know, a telescope that uses big mirrors. And just to look at stars, actually to look at planets around stars, and see if any of them are producing an awful lot of heat. Just look for the infrared radiation coming off these guys. Because a really advanced society would, you know, use a lot of energy, we presume. And, of course, some of that energy inevitably ends up as waste heat. So let's just build a specialized telescope to look for places with waste heat. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know, locating the residents of New Jersey by looking for garbage. But on the other hand, you know, maybe it's the easiest thing to do.
If I might add, I think the one central thing, though, is the only way we can think of seeing any kind of extraterrestrial intelligence is some kind of electromagnetic radiation. I mean, people have talked about other things, neutrinos and whatnot, which are, you know, not very likely. But the question is how to, you know, what part of the electromagnetic band to look at? Do you look at radio waves or visible light, infrared, gamma rays, something like that? But it's hard to imagine any other communication. Now, if there are technologies that are beyond what we've invented, there's some kind of, I don't know, subspace like you see in Star Trek, then, well, the first thing we've got to do is invent that.
Okay, that's a good job for you, Don. But I wanted to bring it back as we're heading toward the top of the hour to UFOs. And Don, you mentioned Galaxy Quest as sort of a fun movie that plays around with the with this whole idea of contact with aliens. Are there other movies or books that you would recommend, either because they just are fun or because they really provide an interesting message about this whole thing with the attraction of the extraterrestrial meme?
Well, of course, there's a ton of wonderful, interesting extraterrestrial stories. There are two that I like to tell people about, but they're fairly common. One I like is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and only because it hits so well all of the various stories that have been told, everything from the Foo Fighters of the 1945 through First Contact through Abduction. And so I like that movie simply because it really does touch so many of the various ideas that have been put forth over the years. But I think something more like Contact, you know, where we're not going to interact with extraterrestrials very likely by them coming here, but by hearing from them from afar.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Seth?
Well, you know, I like all the movies involving aliens. You know, and the cheesier the better. I mean, I hate to say that, but doggone it, it's so much fun when they're cheesy. And, you know, I actually, and I think I mentioned this earlier, I actually do consult occasionally for these movies. And of course, all the ones I've consulted for have turned out to be really bad movies. And I'm trying to decide whether that's a cause and effect relationship. I'm a little concerned it might be. But the facts are that, you know, they're totally unrealistic right from the get-go because they always postulate that the aliens are going to be more or less at the same level we are so that we can either take them on in dogfights with our aircraft or we can maybe mate with them or whatever. I mean, you know, that's the level. They're at our level except for the fact that they've got rockets to get here. And, of course, that doesn't make any sense. So right from the get-go, the premise is wrong. But on the other hand, any movie that's cost more than, you know, $1 million involves a lot of people, a lot of very creative people. And, yeah, maybe they don't know too much about the actual science, but they're creative. And I love to see what they do with the sets, with the situations, with the appearance of not only the aliens, but the environment in which they live. I mean, to me, that is, you know, it's modern fairy stories, and I really like them.
And besides Confessions of an Alien Hunter, are there any books you'd recommend, Seth?
Well, there are endless numbers of books on on this. I'm trying to think of something that, you know, is more attuned to the UFO controversy. And there are many, many UFO books. There aren't terribly many that are skeptical. So, you know, in a way, I guess there's no market for a UFO book that's skeptical. If you're skeptical about the aliens being here, you're probably not going to buy a book about it. But, yeah, no, none come to mind, I have to say. I'll think about that for the next 9 minutes.
And Don, books for you besides Alien Universe?
Well, yeah, I mean, you got to read that. But yeah. I totally agree with Seth. I mean, my Alien Universe book has only done marginally well, and I think it's because it says things like aliens don't look like little gray guys, and the science of it's hard. I was trying to. There's a book by. I think it's actually just called Astrobiology, and it's by it's published by Hopkins. And that one's really nice because it's kind of like the same thing that mine does, but at a little bit more level, goes into a little more detail. And if you're really interested in what aliens are like, you really have to follow the science. You have to follow the physics and the chemistry. I mean, there are only so many substances that can make complex molecules. You're not going to make aliens out of helium, for instance. Carbon is really good because it can make four bonds. And so I think if someone's really interested in aliens, xenobiology is the way to go, because if you learn something about that, then you have a sense about what's really likely governed by the science. Now, that doesn't tell you what it's going to look like, because there are many possibilities, whether the liquid that... is used as water like we do or some other substance. But it really does give you a sense of the realm of the possible. It constrains your speculation. And that's, of course, what we scientists do. You start out with anything, and you start killing the hypotheses that simply don't work. And in the end, you hope that you're left with the few things that are real. And that tells you where to look.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to mention Captured by Aliens, which is a book by Washington Post reporter Joel Achenbach, and that was published in 1999. But if you're interested in that culture that surrounds UFOs as well as the real-life search for extraterrestrial life, I think that hits a lot of the bases. So I would put that on my reading list for UFOs.
I had a thought, one more book called Abducted by Susan Clancy, and she just interviewed people who claimed they were abducted, and it was a very interesting book. There was a subclass of people that I wasn't aware of. They were people who swore that they had been abducted, although they had no memory of being abducted, but they knew they had been abducted somehow, and that was an interesting class of people that I hadn't encountered before I had started researching for my book.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Clancy was interested in the more general question of whether this hypnotic, this technique of using hypnosis to bring back repressed memories was actually legitimate, because some people were accusing relatives of sexual molestation when they were a kid, and they would only make those accusations after being hypnotized, and then suddenly they remembered this stuff. And the question was, you know, could you trust that? Could a court of law trust that? And so what Clancy did was she talked to people who, you know, claimed that they had been abducted by aliens under hypnosis, and she just assumed that they hadn't been, right? She thought that was too much of an assumption to assume that anybody had been ever abducted by aliens. So that was the way she got into that, and it is indeed quite interesting. There was a poll taken about 10 or 15 years ago, and the interpretation of that poll, it was a legitimate organization, but the poll questions weren't very clear. They're a little bit ambiguous. But the general interpretation of that poll was that something like 7% of the American public feels as if it may have been abducted by aliens.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, we're getting toward the top of the hour, so I wanted to ask each of you, starting with Don, what you're up to lately. You're probably not full-time involved in the search for UFOs. Tell me about what you're doing and what's the next chapter for your scientific work.
Well, you're right. I mean, I'm actually not at all thinking about extraterrestrials at the moment, and the reason is because my own scientific interest is to use the big accelerator at the CERN laboratory in Europe, the Large Hadron Collider. And we had a great run from 2010 to 2012. We discovered the last missing link of the standard model, the Higgs boson, and we shut down for 2 years for refurbishment and retrofitting and upgrading and so forth. And in about 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to turn back on and start circulating beam. The machine has over 60% more energy than it did before. We're going to collide 3 times more particles per second than we did before. In essence, it's an entirely new machine studying a new regime. It's going to take a big step into the unknown of the subatomic world, and it will help us answer these timeless questions of how the universe came into existence, why the universe is the way it is, what the rules are, and this is absolutely fascinating to me, and that's actually consuming all of my time.
And I'll just say that we discussed this last month, and anyone who's listening to this might want to turn back to the Blog Talk Radio archive and check out the February show, because we spent the whole hour talking about the Large Hadron Collider, which is a very cool thing. And how about you, Seth? What's up?
Well, we don't have as nice a machine as Don has, I have to say. But we do have the Allen Telescope Array, which is much more modest, but on the other hand, it does a different job. And we are using that, of course, to scan the skies looking for signals that would tell us somebody's out there. Some of the new projects we're considering, I think that we ought to continue to look at the center of our own galaxy. That's the only special place in our galaxy, really special, that everybody will know about. And maybe a very advanced society has set up some sort of big transmitter down there just to get everybody to join up the galactic club or whatever. We'll do that. But also, I'm advocating that we should be doing more observations in the direction of red dwarf stars. And I noticed that some of the comments that have been flying by here during our chat concern red dwarf stars. These are the runts of the galaxy. They're small guys, but they live a very long time. So every red dwarf that has ever been born since the Big Bang is still alive today, still emitting light. Maybe somewhere between 15 and 50% of all red dwarfs might have a habitable planet. That's a result coming out of the Kepler telescope that somebody published not too long ago. Well, that means that the majority of all societies, if there are societies in the universe, are going to be around red dwarf stars. So we're going to start a program to target, many thousands of these red dwarf stars and hope to find somebody at the other end.
Now, Seth, I know that in the past you've talked about what the time frame for making a detection of an extraterrestrial civilization, and sometimes the date 2025 has come up. What's your current thinking on how long it's going to take?
Yeah, this is like practical nuclear fusion, I guess. It's always 20 years in the future, always has been, always will be kind of thing. I said this like 10 years ago, that we'll find ET within 2 dozen years, and I bet everybody a cup of Starbucks on that, which is good news up there in the Seattle area, maybe. But the reason I said that is because just looking at the expected rate of improvement in our SETI experiments and at some of the guesses as to how many societies might be out there, I estimated that we will trip across one within 2 dozen years. I'll reduce that to 20 years because 10 years have gone by, and stick by that and still buy people a cup of coffee if we don't succeed.
There you go. You heard it here first. I'm going to slip in one more question that Albert Gainsburg raised, and he knows that you've debated this, but we might as well just touch on it. Is it really wise for us to consider broadcasting special signals showing our location to, well, the aliens? And this was the subject of a couple of big debates at a recent scientific meeting in San Jose, how we should deal with this issue of letting the aliens know we're here, even if perhaps they're the bad kind of aliens. So could you just kind of sum up your thinking about why this is something that is worth considering, and the pros and the cons of the efforts that we make to make contact?
Yeah, well, there are people, indeed, there are people who are down the hall from where I am, who want to do this, I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it'll teach you something about what the difficulties are for the aliens on the other side, if you will, for the transmitters. And if you have a better understanding of their technical difficulties, then maybe you can design a better listening experiment. As far as the danger, because of the really controversial aspect of all of this is it dangerous to let them know that we're here? And honestly, I don't worry about that too much because we have been broadcasting since the Second World War, FM, radar, television. And those signals, yes, they're much weaker than a deliberate broadcast would be. But on the other hand, any society that's advanced enough to actually be a threat from many, many light years away, any society at that level has bigger antennas, and they can pick up that leakage. So in my opinion, that information is already out there. They already will know we're here as soon as our early TV shows wash over their planet.
Don, I'm going to give you the last word. What do you think is the future of the scientific frontier? And you can feel free to talk about what we're going to find in particle physics or astrobiology or maybe, who knows, genetic engineering. But I just wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on what you thought the next 10 or 20 or 100 or 1,000 years might be like.
Well, 1,000 years is hard to predict, but certainly the thing that impresses me the most, and maybe it's because I'm not an expert on it, is what we've learned about biology and DNA and the origins or the nature of life and working towards the origins of life. That's absolutely fascinating to me. Another thing that I'm finding very interesting of late is some of the work in neurobiology, the understanding of the origins of the mind from the chemistry of the brain. And these are fields that are making very good progress. I'm very glad to see, have Seth do what he's doing, but as he says, his is a luck thing. I mean, he looks in the right place or he doesn't when the guys are broadcasting or whatever. But the fields of the biology and the neurophysiology of the brain, it's just absolutely astounding what's happening. And I think that the chances of those observations totally changing our culture over the course of the next few decades is very, very high.
Well, that's a great note to end on here. I want to thank Seth and Don for being with us tonight, and thanks also to the Exploratorium for hosting us in Second Life, and thanks to our producer, Sherry Reason, with the Virtually Speaking team. It's been a great show. Really glad to have you on, and I'll look forward to having you on again. And Seth, if you're ever up in Seattle, I'll buy the coffee. You don't need to worry about that.
All right. How about some fish dinner?
Okay. I'll even go that far. So for Virtually Speaking Science, I'm Alan Boyle, science editor at NBCNews.com. And for more about the subjects that we've covered tonight, just check out CosmicLog.com or science.NBCNews.com. For Seth, you can go to SETI.org, find out all about that. For Don Lincoln, it's drdonlincoln.com, I believe. Did you have anything you wanted to add in terms of how to get in touch with either of you?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is facebook.com/dr.don.lincoln.
And you, Seth?
Well, they can just go to the SETI Institute website that you just mentioned, or they can just write me at seth@seti.org.
There you go. So once again, I'm Alan Boyle with NBC News, signing off for Virtually Speaking Science. And until next time, watch the skies.